located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach, and welcome. My guest today is short story writer Katie Schultz. Born in Chapel Hill, North Carolina in 1979, her debut collection is entitled Flashes of War, and it's just been published in paperback by Loyola University of Maryland Apprentice Press. Katie will be reading tonight at Annie Bloom's Books in Multnomah Village at 7 p.m. Welcome back to Portland, Katie.
Thank you, Jim.
Why don't you begin by telling us some of your best recollections of growing up in Portland?
Oh, what a great question. Well, it all has to do with coffee and books. That's what it boils down to. And I think also playing soccer. I spent 10 years playing soccer all over the city. That was a big part of my upbringing. And when I live in the South now, and when I have to quickly summarize what it was like to grow up in Portland, I tell them that coffee is the third parent. and they understand somehow. So I spent a lot of time at Powell's. I liked to drive around and just look at things and let the rain fall on my skin. And I liked to hang out in Northwest then, but it wasn't called the Pearl. But I liked walking around there.
When did you first realize that you really wanted to become a writer?
It may have happened my junior year at Wilson High School. I had a really inspiring English teacher, Miss Wood, Carol Wood.
Oh, I know her.
Yeah, she's a wonderful woman, and I think she's walking across Spain right now. We've been corresponding since the book came out, but we studied Thoreau, and I reached a point at some juncture with that, with Walden, and I think she knew it too, and she wrote me a note in my journal that just said, Do you feel like a thinker now? And the answer was yes. And I went on to study philosophy, actually, at Whitman College, and then later the writing. But for me, it always began with some of that hard thinking about language and how that can then open up into story. And it may be fair to say that that began here.
You got an MFA at Pacific. Who were your teachers there, and what were the best things you learned while you were there?
Oh, my goodness. I studied with Judy Blunt and Pete Fromm and Claire Davis. It was amazing to be a part of that program. And I like to say that Judy Blunt taught me about verbs. She is an amazing storyteller, but really, really, she nailed me for using active verbs. And then I like to say that Pete Fromm taught me how to relax. I was very uptight, and I needed to know exactly how to do things, which isn't really how creative writing works. And Claire taught me about passion, just absolutely feeling and loving what you do so much. So between the three of them and then all the other faculty there, I really lucked out.
Who were the writers, or what were the books that came to you during that time and really reassured you that writing was what you wanted to do?
I'm not sure if I could say it was a particular book, but the Pacific faculty as a whole, the way that I saw them come together every January and June was so inspiring, and it made me feel confident that I could come from this foundation that they were offering. And that as long as I stuck with it, I would be okay. They sort of collectively almost put out this this empowering feeling of, all right, we're in it together. And if you love this writing life as much as we do, it's going to work out.
Well, then who were the writers that you found inspiration in?
I read a lot of Steve Almond. For poetry, I read a lot of Joseph Millar and Dorian Lox. I was really moved by Rick Bass, especially the Hermit story. Unbelievable. Michael Cunningham's sentences still completely undo me. Those sentences do cartwheels. It's amazing how he does that. Those are a few. Nowadays, I get really into Amy Bender, Ursula Hedgey, Tom Jones.
Tom Jones. Now, there's a name. Tobias Wolfe and Tom Jones have written some of the best short stories about the Vietnam War, and yet Tom, in The Pugilist at Rest, has three of the best. he never went overseas. He's a Force Recon Marine, but never saw any kind of combat. You're a civilian, no military tradition really in your background. What drew you to war as a subject?
Mm, that's a good question. For me, I think it really began with this idea that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are my generation's wars, but I didn't really feel that in any sort of way that it was impacting me. Here I was living my life, making art, doing my thing, and laughing with my friends. And meanwhile, we had 50,000 soldiers with one or more missing limbs coming home. And that didn't sit well with me. So I needed to look at it. And a short story for me always begins with an unanswered question. That's always, whether it's about war or not. And I had a lot of unanswered questions about these wars. So I began by researching. I began with one word at a time until I could really start to make things up in a way that felt true.
It's my understanding that the only thing harder to place than a debut short story collection is a singular novella. How difficult was it for you to find a publisher?
It was hard, especially because Flashes of War has 26 flash fictions and then 7 full-length stories, so it's a bit wonky in terms of marketing. I think it was a total of 44 presses that I submitted to before Loyola University got on board.
How have you maintained yourself financially during all of this time while you were writing the book?
I do freelance write a little bit. I write about contemporary American ceramics. And then I travel sometimes to teach. I teach every year at Interlochen Center for the Arts in some capacity. And I was also a writer in residence at Fish Trap, so I did a bit of teaching there. And through that, I have met a wonderful group of writers of all ages, and some of them have wanted to continue working with me, so they send me their writing every month, and we work together via correspondence. I also live very simply. I keep my overhead low.
Now, where do you live these days?
I live in a little place called Selah, North Carolina, in the South Hill River Valley of the Black Mountains, which are the highest range that side of the Mississippi, and I live in an Airstream trailer bordering the Pisgah National Forest. All 284 square feet of that place.
One of the problems that we face in this era is the millions of refugees. In Syria alone, 5 million refugees, 2 million outside the country, 3 million internal. Iraq has sent millions away from Iraq. It strikes me that refugees are the problem these days, and we must find a way to deal with them in a better way than we have thus far. I'd like you to read the story Refugee for us, if you would, Katie.
Sure. Refugee. I took my family, and we did what we were told, leaving our house in Fallujah before the second U.S.-led assault. I paid all my money and one basket of food to a cab driver outside the city. He took us as far as our money would go, about 7 miles from the Al-Hadra district of Baghdad. We walked the rest of the way, my wife and 2 daughters, plus 3 satchels of belongings that I slung over my back and carried like a camel. I remember feeling the sun warm my shoulders and the taste of dust kicked up along the road. Some days it felt as though those were the only things left untouched in Iraq, ceaseless heat and tiny particles of the past that could survive any method of warfare. I heard Doctors Without Borders had set up a camp at Al-Hadra for families like ours. I didn't know who they were or why they would come, but they took us in. We stayed in pole tents with thousands of others, all of this in a district already as crowded as a rug factory. Volunteers served small meals 3 times a day. Others showed us how to set up tents for families that kept coming. We raised walls, hammered stakes, and secured door flaps, all without speaking each other's language. It didn't matter. The work needed doing. We did it together. The city sang around us, sometimes air raids, other times the ritual calls to prayer. Within a week, my wife found sewing work in Baghdad. During the daytime, tents were only for the sick or elderly, so my daughters played outside. Without any schools, gangs of youth loitered between rows of tents. One afternoon, an elderly woman died, and a small crowd of orphan boys took her santor to entertain themselves with music. They danced and clapped, unashamed of their thievery. Other times, the gangs grew restless and taunted each other or dared girls in no good games. A crippled teen played on my daughters for sympathy, showing them the stump of his contorted left arm, the fleshy stub where his elbow should have been. When Salia came to find me, she said, "That place, Father. He's showing Mishar that place in his pants." I found them in a partially collapsed tent, the cripple's pants unzipped, and Mishar with her hands over her face, crying for what she had seen. I shoved the cripple and kicked the rest of the tent down, leaving him trapped to fend for himself. Each night inside the tents, men and women wept openly. The wounded slept alongside the healthy. Families argued like bleeding goats. One time, a man next to me pounded his fists into his cot repeatedly, refusing to stop. It took four of us to brace his arms behind his back. He looked old and failing, his breath hot and stale on my face. "Yalla, yalla," he kept shouting. He wanted to go back. He wanted to fight and protect his home. Didn't we all? 7 months later, families were allowed to go back. We rode together in a convoy of U.S. Marines. Those men looked indestructible, and yet I knew, we all knew, that the fight in our city had been their hardest yet. I worried for my fellow Fallujans who stayed behind. We moved slowly along the road, and part of me wondered if the convoy was a farce, if the Fallujah I had always known would be completely erased from the earth. It took almost 14 hours to re-enter the city. A fence encircled the perimeter with only three secured gates for thousands of Fallujans. But these were my people. I felt certain we could thrive again. In line together, we prayed for a new time of peace. I could hardly stand the waiting. I wanted to see my beloved city again, the city of mosques. I could almost taste our famous kebabs and hear vendors singing their prices into the streets. The only blessing while we waited was reuniting with friends we hadn't seen since the invasion. Malik the butcher, Hakim the street vendor, Uday the chai boy, little slices of our neighborhood returning home like so many migrating birds. Almost as many were missing. Mohammed, Jamal, Abida the barber with the funny western mustache. Finally, we neared the gate. I peered through a ticket window and spotted half a dozen soldiers and shelf after shelf of hardware. It sounded like a swarm of electronic flies beeping and humming in a generator-powered cacophony. The Marines took our daughters first and pressed their tiny fingertips onto a curious electronic pad. Then they took profile shots and bantered with a translator about our names and street address. Next, they scanned our eyes and turned the images into code. Finally, they led us, exhausted and thirsty, over to a waiting area along the fence. Already, elders fainted in the sun. When the Marines tried to help, their boss came out and hollered at them to stop. 30 minutes later, we received biometric badges. "Welcome to the 21st century," the Marine said. A translator repeated in Arabic. "If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to worry about. These identification cards can't be misplaced. They're your only pass for this gate. They give you permission to enter your neighborhood. You're prohibited elsewhere. If you lose your cards, you're suspect. If you disobey the boundaries, you're considered hostile." I stuffed the cards into my breast pocket. The girls could hardly move, so I carried Salia on my back, her tiny brown legs flapping as we walked. When we got to our block, I knew immediately we should not have come. The wall surrounding our small apartment lay crushed into hunks of jagged concrete and stone. The entire roof had been cleanly peeled away as though someone lifted jam off the top of a pastry. Crooked spires of rebar poked into the sky where our second-story bedrooms used to be. I made my family wait in the street while I ducked beneath a crumbling archway and into the remains of our kitchen. Alone amidst the rubble, I thought about the old man from the tents at Al-Hadra, the one who couldn't be quieted. I curled my fists and pounded till my knuckles bled into the stone. I would have to face my family empty-handed, to tell them we had nothing, that the tents at Al-Hadra offered more than our very own home. I thrashed and kicked, and the ID cards tumbled from my pocket onto the floor. They shone brightly against the dark rubble. I could still smell the fresh plastic lining each card, a toxic omen for the new Fallujah.
Thanks for reading that, Katie. You traveled rather widely in researching this book. Tell us a bit about how you did that and who you met.
Sure. I traveled from writing fellowship to writing fellowships, and I ended up spending 31 out of 36 months on the road. It was an incredible, exciting, exhausting time. And I did not travel to interview soldiers, though. There were a few that I spoke to along the way, one about life on a forward operating base, just the logistics of it, and then another about the steps for recruitment. And beyond that, the travel was to get from one residency to another so that I could work on the book. And the residencies were great because I had endless amounts of time to research using things like Google Maps, Google Images, YouTube, a lot of Netflix documentaries, and a lot of nonfiction reading. I did not read fiction about the wars while I was writing it. That would have been too complicated, but a lot of nonfiction.
Was there a particular book that was most fruitful for you?
Doug Stanton's Horse Soldiers was really helpful in understanding just the basics of 21st century warfare, what we can do nowadays and some of the ways in which we're moving troops on the ground.
I've read a book recently by Dr. Jonathan Shea called Achilles in Vietnam, Combat Trauma and the Undoing of Character. In fact, mm-hmm. he goes back to Greek history and Homer to get the perspective, but he shows that while the names have changed, the stresses remain the same. What have you seen of PTSD in your travels and your research for this book?
I haven't seen very much at all, to be honest, because I didn't really interview many soldiers or spend any time on, I've never been on a military base. So I don't know that I can say too much about that. I researched a little bit about the ways in which flashbacks might happen, but I don't think anything that I discovered was particularly, you know, came out in a particularly inventive way in the book.
Staff Sergeant Robert Bales recently pled guilty in a court-martial to killing 16 Afghan civilians. Because there's no actual court-martial taking place, we're really not going to learn much about why or what happened. Did you find that there were a lot of people who were unwilling to talk about what they'd experienced?
I didn't find myself in the company of people that I even thought to ask. I really was mostly just spending time in the fellowships with artists and other mediums. So that didn't really come up in my experience.
America is armorer to the world. I mean, we produce 65% of the weaponry. We sell war material around the world. We have a defense budget that's larger than the five next greatest nations. It strikes me that perhaps as a country, we should be familiar with war guilt. What do you think?
I know what I think for myself.
All right, and what is that?
I feel like we just need to keep looking a little more closely. There's something going on with these wars where the American public doesn't really have to touch them. And even as we've seen ourselves through this great recession, we don't seem to be talking too much about $200 million a week still being spent in Afghanistan, for example, which is not to say we don't still need to be spending that money. You could argue either way with that. But let's look for a minute at those numbers, and let's look for a minute at the number of years or the fact that my teenage cousins have no living memories of their country when we weren't at war. Somehow we've gotten ourselves in this situation where we, for the most part, can just keep going without having to get too close. And I think that's dangerous territory. It creates a new normative behavior that's going to have consequences for generations.
Would you give us a reading now from the story AWOL?
Sure.
And for those of you who may have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today, short story writer Katie Schultz, who will be appearing tonight at Annie Bloom's Books in Multnomah Village, now reading from her story AWOL.
Before going AWOL, I only thought about Canada when that South Park movie came out a few years back. Blame Canada, the cartoon characters jeered. The tune sounded catchy. I remember that much. Otherwise, hockey, maple syrup, and a big cheerful-looking flag. That's Canada, right? Now, Canada's the country that took me in. Toronto is the city with organizations for guys like me, and this small block near Withrow Park has become my barracks. A family here lets me stay for free while I sort things out. I don't like to judge, But I don't like being betrayed either. Whenever I do make it back home to Cleveland, I expect to be laughed at. I never even finished my first tour. 7 months outside Sauter City, then the Army sent me home for a week in November. I never returned. Mom couldn't feed me enough that visit. Said I look like a bunch of hungry mussels. Said she ought to know she's the one that raised me. I sat down at the Thanksgiving table, feast spread as long as a football field. Dad carved into the 18-pound bird, and Uncle Pat started in on the honey-baked ham. I leaned back in my chair, watching the way the meat peeled from the bone, tender and fatty, like a limb severed by the blast from an IED. While at home, I got the email from one of the company commanders back in Iraq. They wanted the incident report for 12 November 07, paperwork I'd been remiss in filling out for almost 2 weeks at that point. Right there at my dad's desk, I could feel the heat of Sauter City, its dry dust gathering in my mouth. The way the Iraqis stared at us, running patrol after patrol through their neighborhoods and houses. How their irises looked so dark, when I met civilians gaze for gaze, I only saw my own reflection, 100 tiny me's shining back. It made it hard to shake the sight of myself. All that ammo and camo, my tight-lipped expression, nothing like the man I wanted to be. If I filled out the report, I'd have to admit that disobeying my superiors to save lives was an unacceptable infraction. The Army wasn't placing blame, they just didn't want a spoiler like me trying to change the SOP. I'd made it through basic and advanced individual training, even made it through a heckling captain, and finally a promotion to private first class. But this single-page report that would tidy up a 2-hour mission and 6 dead Iraqis? Well, I never responded to the commander's email. Just double-clicked it into the trash along with my tour in Iraq, and right then and there started an internet search to get myself up north. The Army doesn't search too hard, but I plan to turn myself in for a trial, eventually. Me and all our Capitol Hill gurus, the almighty creators of this betrayal. The day those suit coats ante up for crimes against humanity, I'll ante up for AWOL. I can almost see us walking shoulder to shoulder through the gates of a military prison. During my hard labor, I'll sweat readily from the work, the life I left in Ohio slowly coming back to me each day I serve my sentence. And the suit coats, they'll work with double the weight on their backs, the ghosts of innocent Iraqis pressing them deeper into the ground.
Thanks for reading that, Katie. What was the effect of writing this book on you?
I've certainly changed my opinion about the wars and about service. I mean, when I first began, in a way, I almost couldn't imagine why someone would enlist. And I realize that's a naive viewpoint, but I don't think I'm the only one who felt that way or feels that way. And I certainly don't have that sentiment now. There are all kinds of reasons. So that's one big thing that changed. Another thing that changed for me was I feel like I believe more thoroughly than ever before in how complicated war really is. Every time in a story I tried to place blame or point a finger, I couldn't do it. It wasn't believable. The more I researched, the more complex I realized things were, and it was not black and white. You can't say it began here. Just as now we're having a hard time saying it ends here.
I interviewed one of my favorite people, Dr. Robert J. Lifton, on his book, Home from the War, Vietnam Veterans, Neither Victims Nor Executioners. Mm-hmm. And I think he portrayed what the whole thing was about. We could not place blame on any one person, but we cannot absolve a person of blame either.
Mm-hmm.
Who's writing these days really commands your attention, Katie?
Steve Almond is an author I go to again and again. He has an older story collection called My Life in Heavy Metal that is just out of this world in terms of the word choice and the language. And Tom Jones, as I said, really what it is for me is it's two things. It's a writer whose language at the line level completely owns the character and the worldview, whatever that worldview may be. And then it's also, I'm really interested in insatiable characters. And Amy Bender's good at that. Even magical realism or not, she just can really nail it. She's got these female characters that are relentless, but in somehow quiet ways and sort of privately relentless. But it comes out as really powerful on the page.
What are you looking forward to doing in the next few years, Katie?
I'd like to get my novel published.
You have a novel?
I do. I have the draft of a novel, and the last story in Flashes of War inspired it. I was so taken by Nathan, this character, and he stayed with me, and I wanted to know how he got where he got in this book, so I wrote the novel that answered that question. It takes place in Afghanistan, and it all takes place in one day.
Wow. I wonder, would you give us a reading now from your story, My Dog and Me? And this is a return story, but certainly it has the effect of war within it.
Sure. This is a classic example of a flash fiction, so a very short piece. Just the dog and me. I'm outside in the middle of the night again. Just the dog and me. The whole neighborhood's asleep. Cooper sniffing every blade of grass, checking the perimeter of the yard. Just the kind of thing that drives Marcia nuts, but I can be patient. I can be patient with his mini mission to protect and defend, because the longer I watch him, the more I understand his logic. He's all tail and nose, tugging the leash this way and that, sending muted snorts into the night, a canine Morse code. Any minute now, the neighbor's beagle will probably hear us, set the whole block singing. Cooper freezes for a moment, the leash tight between us. Then before I know it, he's sending up more dirt than a landmine, and I just drop the leash and let him dig. It's a beautiful thing, going after what you want like that. Some nights, I see shooting stars by the dozen out here. They streak across the sky like tracer fire, faster than you can say, incoming. Tonight, though, the moon's a smile, and when Cooper lifts his muzzle from the hole to see if I'm still here, watching his back, I can barely make out a shape through the dark. I hear the click of the front door, and Marcia steps outside. "Patrick, is that you again?" she whispers. "Are you out there?" I don't say a thing, but I can sense Cooper as he turns with me toward the door. He takes point, and we move silently through the grass. Marcia doesn't hear us until we're close enough for me to put my arm around her waist and say, "Right here, baby, I'm right here." She yelps and does a little half-hop across the porch. "Cooper's licking my toes," she says. "He's tickling me." Then she laughs, and it must be the easiest sound I've heard in years. It doesn't take much before the neighbor's dog starts yowling, which only makes Marcia laugh louder, and I'm thinking, yeah, that's it. We're all out here just trying to get somebody to listen, aren't we?
Thanks for reading that, Katie. Has any writer given you advice that you found was very important to maintaining the writerly life?
Oh, lots of them. Yeah. It really boils down to balance and putting the time in. At Pacific, we used to say the tush in chair method, mm-hmm. highly technical process. So that came kind of universally from the Pacific faculty. And then I spent a week with Molly Gloss in Imnaha Canyon as a part of a fish trap retreat. And it was really good to see another writer who I respect and who's quite successful, see how she worked to balance between reading, writing, some time outdoors, healthy doses of chocolate.
When you want to recreate yourself, where do you go and what do?
I go outside. I exercise. I got to get my heart rate going, and I hike. Almost half the book was written on fellowships in Alaska.
Really?
And a big part of that, I think, was because it's so profoundly beautiful and expansive up there that I was able to go really deep and dark with the book and then spend hours outside sort of recharging.
And where would you say is your favorite place to go?
Well, my favorite place in the whole world is Wallowa County, Oregon.
Really?
But I'm biased since I was just there yesterday. But it really is beautiful. It's the county that's got it all.
And coming up, you have a reading also in Pendleton?
Yeah, I'll be at Word Roundup this year in Pendleton. So I'm reading at 2 o'clock on Friday in Pendleton.
And I understand you're reading coming up in New York City, too.
I do. I was invited by Words After War to read with a host of other war literature authors on November 2nd at 4 p.m. at Acme Studios.
And you're also a finalist for a War Literature Award. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, the Military Writers Society of America has nominated Flashes of War for Book of the Year, and they announced the winner on Saturday.
Well, that's wonderful. And I'd like to thank all of you for joining us today. My guest today is short story writer Katie Schultz. Her debut collection, Flashes of War, has just been published in paperback by Loyola Apprentice Press. Thanks very much for dropping by this morning, Katie. It's been wonderful having you here.
Thank you so much, Jim.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Raven's Flight Creative, presenting an evening with Molly Ringwald, performing jazz and speaking on her life experiences, 7 p.m. Friday, September 27th at the Newmark Theater in Portland. The performance will be followed by a meet and greet, and tickets and information are available at ravensflightcreative.com.
KBOO Book and Record Sale is back. KBOO's annual book and record sale happens Saturday, September 28th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Not only will there be fabulous books, CDs, and vinyl to grab at ridiculously low prices, but it will also be a madcap fun community event. There will be KBOO DJs spinning live all day and baked goods available for a donation. All proceeds from the day benefits KBOO, your community radio station. It all happens at the Musicians Union at 325 Northeast 20th on Saturday, September 28th. That's 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. Questions? Contact Ani at volunteer@kboo.org. For more information, check out kboo.fm.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito.